just the fastest thing you'll ever see. That streak of lightning you just missed was me. Don't stop now, you gotta keep it going all night. Rolling stock, rolling stock.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio This Week on Broadway for August 15th, 2010. My name is James Marino, and on the call this afternoon, we have Peter Felicia and Matthew Murray. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com, writes for the Newark Star-Ledger, and also writes for Masterworks Broadway. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
With us also is Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic for talkingbroadway.com and also writes for Broadway Stars. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, everyone.
So we have kicked off the Fringe Festival. When did it start, Matthew? Did it start today?
Or started Friday.
Friday? So yep. we're a few days into it, and Peter and Matthew have seen a bunch of shows, and so we're going to dedicate most of the show today to talking about that. Matthew, why don't you give us a rundown of what you have seen, and we'll see if you have something common with Peter.
Well, so far, we're recording this Sunday morning, and I've seen seven shows so far. And I am seeing four more today. And of the seven shows that I've seen three that have been legitimately good: the Hurricane Katrina Comedy Festival, AK-47 Sing Along, and The Swearing Jar. The Hurricane Katrina Comedy Festival is a bit misleading in terms of its title. It's not really a sort of satirical, concept-driven show the way the title might suggest, but it deals with five people who are all telling their different stories about what happened there and how they interlock and the emotions and the things that happened there. And it's really well done. The play is written by Rob Florence, and I had seen another Hurricane Katrina related show from him about 4 years ago that was much different in tone and much darker and really not quite as effective as this one, because this one really focuses a lot on the people and what they're going through and how they really come out of it on top. And there's a blurb on the front of the program that says, well, you know, is it possible that when the mayor of New Orleans was considering the idea of a comedy show to celebrate the year anniversary of Katrina, is it possible that he meant comedy in a classic sense in terms of having a happy ending and all that? And that is the way the show is organized, and in that way it's really smart, because you do get an idea that these are good people, and despite all the bad stuff that happened, they eventually came out of it okay. So I saw that on Friday, and that was really a good way to kind of kick the festival off. Then yesterday,
Matthew, yes. Let me interrupt here for a couple of reasons. First off, I saw it too. Okay. I saw it on Friday night late. Is that when you were there?
I was there. I was in the back. I came in almost before they closed the house, because I was running from another theater.
Yes, there was an amazing thing that I've never had happen to me before in the theater, and it was so fascinating. Here was this play unfolding about this tragedy, about this disaster, and everybody on stage, and I don't mean this as a criticism, I don't, because I have great respect for the piece too, was, for want of a better word, wailing. There was a lot of pain on stage, of course, because people are losing their house, their possessions, their lives. And suddenly, from the middle of the house, there was this tremendous scream. And for a split second, all of us, I think, in the theater did not know if this was something that was part of the play or not.
I couldn't tell.
I couldn't tell either. And that's what was so amazing to me, that here's where theater is at its best, because it's unpredictable. And when something strange and unforeseen happens, you can't be sure at that few seconds if indeed it's part of the show or not. If it were in a movie, of course you would know. A TV show, you would know. But it was an amazing slice of life where suddenly we heard this big scream and we didn't know what to do. And Lizanne Mitchell, who gives a wonderful performance, suddenly just stopped and stared. And that's when we knew that indeed this was not part of the show. The house lights came up. And yes, indeed, a woman was having an epileptic fit. We actually heard, is there a doctor in the house? The strange thing about this is it didn't last long. And while I don't believe the woman particularly returned to normalcy right away, the people with her seemed to indicate it was under control. And Lizanne Mitchell had to start the show again. And I think it's a great tribute to the cast and to the audience that they were able to get so much back into the show, considering that we had just had this tremendously scary interruption, considering also that the people around the woman made us feel it was all right to go on, certainly gave us permission, but to get into the show again, and the actors too. But the actors were not rattled in the worst sense of the word by this, and they really resumed what they were doing, and the audience really responded again the way they had responded just before this terrible thing had happened. At the end of the show, ironically enough, which was about a half hour later maybe, when we were filing out, there was an ambulance outside, and there were medical people who came down the aisle and dealt with this woman. I don't understand, frankly, why she wasn't taken out, or why the people with her felt that keeping her there was a good idea. But what's also sad, too, is that I am talking much more about this incident than I'm talking about the show. And the show really does deserve tremendous attention. Yes, I wonder if the playwright chose this name about Comedy Festival, because there's very little comedy in this show. What is there is fine, but nevertheless, it is a story about Katrina, and therefore it's a sad story. But I think he may have even chosen this title to feel that he could get more people in by it. That's a guess, but certainly
it's a very good fringe festival title.
I hear you. That's a very good point, and I certainly don't disagree with that. But nevertheless, it is a quality piece of work. I will admit that when it started, I did feel a little sense of, oh, it's one of these again, where a few people will play many people, and it's documentary and all that. But again, I've seen plenty of these, but audiences haven't. So as a result, I respect that. But the question is it well done? Yes, it is well done. And I think the acting is really quite fine. In addition to Lizanne Mitchell, I have to single out Philip Hoffman as a man who's done pretty well in life and now finds that all he's achieved does not mean very much at all. And Maureen Silliman, who plays a number of roles, but nevertheless, she has to play everyone from an older woman to a developmentally disabled one, too. And they really caught my attention. But to be fair, they're all wonderful. And I do think it's a worthy piece. And I'm not surprised that while I've only seen three shows at the Fringe so far, I'm not surprised that Matthew, having seen seven, chose to mention this one first.
Well, I mentioned it first chronologically.
I've seen
a couple of others that I've liked too, but
it's
a really good one I saw. But just to wrap this up, regarding what Peter's saying, he's right that technically all of the actors play multiple people, but each one of them has one character that they play to a majority. Each one of them has one character that they play a majority of the time, and then the rest of the time it's a line here and a line there. They don't. It's not like five people play 90 characters. It's like five people play 11 characters, but five of them take up 85% of the running time. So it really is a case where you get to know the individual people very well, and as a result of that, it feels a little bit more like a traditional play than a documentary kind of thing like The Laramie Project, for example. And that I think does work in its favor. And it makes a pretty good evening, and it's only about 80, 85 minutes long. Again, it's hard to know the exact running time of the performance that Peter and I saw, but it's very short and it's very brief, and it's very effective, and I liked it quite a bit. It's not quite my favorite show so far, but I guess I've had really good luck, because 3 out of 7 really ain't bad at all. The other two I've seen that I really liked were AK-47 Sing Along, which is at the Heer Arts Center. We didn't mention this, but we probably should, that the Hurricane Katrina Comedy Festival is at the Soho Playhouse. AK-47 at the Heer Arts Center deals with something that I remember making the news. Unfortunately, I don't remember when it was. I want to say it was last year sometime, about a video clip of a Hamas children's TV show that got out, where the lead characters basically advocate extermination of the Jews and are trying to brainwash the kids who are watching it into fighting the Jewish people who are bombing them and doing this and all of that. And one of the characters is a giant rabbit who, like on Sesame Street, which becomes important later in the play, is someone, you know, the kids will like and think is cute and funny and relate to. And they're using him to get out this message of hate. And that's what AK-47 Sing-Along is based on. It's by Samara Weiss, who is a young playwright I've never heard of. But she really does a very smart thing in the way that she relates the story of this kind of Sesame Street knockoff with the story of two people who work on actual sanctioned versions of Sesame Street in the Middle East. In the Middle East, there's one who works on the Jewish version in Israel, and then there's one who works in the Arab version I don't remember where it is exactly. But there's one who works on the Jewish version in Israel, and then there's one who works on the Arab version. And originally, they worked on the same show because at one point, there was just one version of Sesame Street that catered to Jewish and Arab kids. But after the Oslo Accords fell apart in 2000, they split up the show because they didn't think it was realistic to show Jewish and Arab kids getting along. And that's really sad, but it happened. And the play is about the Jewish guy and the Arab guy talking on the phone and just sort of dealing with the world that's collapsing around them, while it's intercut with the scenes from this horrifically terrible Hamas sort of children's show knockoff of it, where, as in real, again, I want to stress, this is all based on something that actually happened and is continuing to happen because the show is still running. But one of the kind of quote-unquote running gags, which, again, is happening in the real show, is that every so often the big fuzzy bunny character is killed off by the Jews and then replaced with someone else who comes in to avenge the previous character's death. And they sort of use that to stoke the anger of the host of the show, who's a 12-year-old girl, and they have callers who are like 7 and 8 years old call into the show and say, "Oh my God, I'm so upset that they killed Nisser, who's the rabbit. You know, I want to kill the Jews who did this to him." And that's how they do it. That's how they propagate hate. And it's so fascinating to watch that happen. And it, besides that, though, it's really a very strong play emotionally. I have a few little quibbles with the writing. There are just places where she probably tries to do a little bit too much and tries to make too many political statements with it. But it really is fascinating and very sad to see how the children are being brought into this whole conflict over them that, of course, they have nothing to do with. And then how that bleeds over into a Jewish girl's dad who works on one Sesame Street and his longtime friend who works on the other Sesame Street. It's something that I never would have thought would be a subject for a play, but it works out so well, and it really shows you what the two sides have in common and where their differences are. And I don't think you're going to learn much about what's going on over there if you don't already follow it. But if you do follow it, it's a very good theatrical representation of it. And I have my interesting story with it, which is a story about the Fringe Festival in general, is the only reason I saw it yesterday is because I misestimated the running time of the show I was seeing earlier, and it got out just as the next show I was supposed to see, which is at least a 10-minute walk away, was starting. So I had an extra block of time I didn't plan on, and I just looked at the schedule, said, "Well, what can I possibly see? What can I see?" And I found that, and I ran down there to get there just in time to see it, and it ended up being really good. So if you have plans for the Fringe Festival and they don't entirely work out, always look at your Fringe guide and the calendar to see what else is playing, because you never know what you're going to wander into. The third and final of the shows I've seen that really deserves to be talking about is called The Swearing Jar, and it is by Kate Hewlett. It is from Canada. She apparently is an actress who I've never heard of, but really want to hear from again, who was on Stargate Atlantis and has done a bunch of other television work that I have never seen. But she's really an excellent playwright. And the thing that really is most amazing about The Swearing Jar to me is it's 60 minutes long, give or take. It might be 65. And it covers so much ground in that time. When I got out of the Connolly Theater, which is on the Lower East Side, East 220 East 4th Street, I think, and saw one of those parking meters that has a time on it, which is usually how I tell time when I'm around the city, it said 8:07 or whatever, because it had taken me a couple of minutes to get out of the theater. And I was literally speechless. And Peter and James know me, and everyone who's listening to the show knows that getting me to shut up is not very easy. So really, I was just like, I can't believe how short the show was, because it felt like a full-length play. And I mean that in a good way, because it's about this woman named Carrie, who Hewlett plays, who is married to a man named Simon and is about to have his baby. And they have this whole thing about how they want the baby to grow up, in, you know, healthy and happy and smart. So they're going to give up alcohol and they're going to give up swearing, which they both do quite a bit. And very colorfully, I have to add. So they put a big jar on the table. And every time one of them says something that is not so nice, they throw in $5. And over the course of the play, the jar just keeps filling up until it's full at the end. And it's very funny. But interspersed with this are scenes that are set at the husband Simon's 40th birthday concert, which Carrie, who's a music teacher and a composer, is throwing for him. And it's kind of a tribute to him and the life he's lived, using the songs that she wrote for her. And it's also alternating with scenes about Carrie meeting a guy named Owen in a bookstore and coming to have a very close relationship with him as well. And the sort of catalyst of the story happens when Carrie and Simon are eating lunch at a picnic in a park, and Simon's mother comes by and sees them together. And Carrie and Simon's mother have a very strange exchange. There's hurt there, and there's confusion, and there's just sort of questioning about what's going on. And you think you understand why the mother is so upset to see Carrie, why Carrie is so upset to see the mother, but maybe you really don't. Maybe there's something else going on. Maybe Simon has a role in, maybe Owen has a role in this that's different from what you think it is, and maybe Simon isn't exactly playing the role you expect him to. And it's very moving how she juggles the relationships with the two men, and how she sort of comes to terms with having the baby and what she goes through. And if it sounds like I'm skirting over huge aspects of the plot, I admit I am, but that's because it's a very short show, and to talk about it too much is to give away vital plot details that frankly are so well considered and so well developed, again, within an hour time frame, that you can give away major secrets just by talking about basic plot points. So I would say that it's very early, I admit, but just judging by the amount of Fringe Festival shows I usually see and the overall quality of the straight plays that I generally observe there, this is already way, way in front of the average. So if you get a chance, you have an extra hour to spend, plus the 15 minutes it'll take you to get to the Connolly Theater, I highly recommend it. It's an amazing work, and I think that as both an actress and a playwright, Kate Hewlett is an astounding talent who really deserves to be watched.
All right, so Matthew, you said speechless. That it made you speechless, did it?
I know. Obviously, I've recovered since then.
Excellent. Well, Peter, we know that you saw the first one. What were the other shows that you'd like to talk about that are from the Fringe?
Sure. The other two I saw were Picking Palin and Made in Taiwan. So Picking Palin is about what may or may not have gone on when John McCain needed a candidate a few years ago. And these are his advisors. These are the people who are really in charge, the ones who will give their recommendations, and he will follow because they're smarter than he is. That's what's established. They're not shy about saying something like that either. We can see through the process they don't have all that much respect for him. A little. They know his strengths, they know his weaknesses, and they're certainly going to talk about some of those. So one advisor, played wonderfully by an actor named William Timoney, is there deciding who to pick, and he's he finds on a blog somebody mentioning nice things about Sarah Palin, and that sets the wheels in motion. The play is about 80 minutes long, I would say maybe 90, and all that happens is what you expect to happen. Like 1776, you know how this is going to turn out. And the suspense isn't nearly as good. But what this play does that's very interesting and to some people will be valuable and to some people will be horrifying is that it reminds us of who Sarah Palin was and is. The lack of experience, her need to succeed, her credentials ranging from a runner-up in a beauty pageant to somebody who has done not such good things for much of the populace in Alaska. And even though there's no question what's going to happen, what is fascinating is to be reminded of who Sarah Palin is. And I found it very valuable for that reason. I will certainly give an editorial comment here that I am not a Sarah Palin fan. So as a result, this play struck me as valuable in its way of reminding people. I know others will feel differently from different political feelings, but nevertheless, this was mine. So as a play, is it any good? It's okay. But it may have value in another arena. So I think Americans could really profit from seeing this play. But in terms of entertainment, not so much. Though Bill Timoney is really marvelous because what he does is really have all the answers, is utterly confident that every move he makes at all times is the correct answer. There's a nice tinge of smarminess to him, a nice superiority, a nice superciliousness, and his performance is right on target. He doesn't overdo it, which is really quite wonderful. And I'm very impressed that he is able to do this without crossing the line. So I will say, for those who don't like Sarah Palin, this might be a treat. For those who do, it won't. But it certainly was valuable to me in having my own political feelings validated. So that was Picking Palin. The other one I saw was a one-woman show, and God knows.
Peter, could I interrupt you for a second? So tell me about the history of political theater on Broadway and off Broadway. And, you know, we don't seem to see shows that are all out attacks on a political ideology or person these days. It doesn't seem like it. I can't remember any off the top of the head of my head. What do you think about these type of plays, and is it something that the Fringe Festival has revived, or is it something that is thriving elsewhere?
Well, I don't know about thriving elsewhere, but I do recall an article written by a freelance writer that made the Sunday section of the Times some years ago, talking about the fact that it's very hard for political plays to succeed now because there's so much politics on cable TV that, you know, be it Fox News, be it all the other, be it CNN, that the theater has really been there, that we really can see plays that tell it like it is in a much more fascinating and detailed and perhaps accurate and perhaps unbiased, I'll take back the Fox News comment on that, way of presenting the material. And I remember that article very well, though I don't remember who wrote it, but I remember nodding my head at the time. Yeah, there was a time, certainly, when there were plays that were successful, such as The Best Man, dealing with how candidates are chosen, or even Lawrence and Lee's The Gang's All Here, which is about how Warren G. Harding got elected. That wasn't a hit, but it certainly was a play about how this guy out of nowhere came out to be elected president. And indeed, Picking Palin has something in common with that, because this is this woman who came out of nowhere and certainly has stayed in the public arena. I've often wondered, by the way, how John McCain feels. Does he feel every time he sees her on TV, I made this woman, you know? And I wonder how he feels. feels. Is he glad that he did it? Does he wish he'd go? But that's another play entirely. And maybe somebody will write that, or maybe somebody will talk about that tonight on CNN, or certainly not Fox News, I'll grant you. But nevertheless, we'll see what happens. But yeah, I think it's also, frankly, let's face it, there has been I'm looking for a euphemism. I can't find it. I'm going to go with dumbing down of much of what's happened on Broadway. So heady political material may only be relegated to the fringe where prices are lower and you don't need as big audiences to at least succeed on that level. I granted all these shows want to wind up going on and on and on and to bigger arenas and to much greater fame and fortune. But the fact remains that if you have a political play, this might be the place to go now, because indeed you will get an audience that is more interested in it, because fringe audiences tend to be aware more of what's going on if they're right there at the fringe, because this is, after all, not front page news in theater sections. So as a result, I think it has to do with that we just get too much of it in other places, and indeed people want to be more entertained today with sillier fare than political plays will offer.
All righty. So,
I'm sorry, James. Can I just step in for a quick minute here? There have been some political plays in recent years, especially that were critical of President Bush. David Hare's Stuff Happens and Tim Robbins' Embedded were both at the Public, and they were both very, very sharp critiques of the Bush administration. In terms of Stuff Happens specifically, I mean, George W. Bush was a character in the show, and in Embedded, he might not have been a character, but his actions and his policies regarding the war in Iraq were certainly first and foremost what the play was about. And of course, there was also the Will Ferrell show earlier this year about, I'm sorry, it was last year now, about, you know, the You're Welcome, America, Final Evening with George W. Bush, which was an evening-length impersonation of Bush as well. So there are these plays out there that are in more mainstream venues, but I do generally agree with Peter that you're more likely to see them regularly at festivals for all the reasons Peter stated, but they are out there, and they do even sometimes get as far as Broadway.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I have a feeling if Will Ferrell didn't want to do that show, that it wouldn't have wound up on Broadway, and the other two shows weren't as high profile. I'm not disagreeing with you, really. Those plays are definitely worth mentioning, and certainly support what you're saying, but I do suspect that if somebody from the fringe had done You're Welcome, America, that it wouldn't have wound up at the Court.
I agree with you, and I think you're right. I would also just take issue with there not being high profile. Personally, I think anything at the Public is high profile, maybe not Broadway level high profile, but high profile within the theater industry, because the Public is one of those theaters where if you follow theater, you have to know what it's doing. And so from that standpoint, at least, I think that those can be considered major political works. Maybe not popularly successful or even financially successful, but I think that they're visible enough to deserve to be considered. But you're right about everything else you said. So, oh, sorry, Kerr. Sorry.
All right, Peter. So what was the other show that you were going to mention before I cut you off?
Made in Taiwan, which is a one-woman show, and it's a young woman talking about her relationship with her mother and her father. All right, that's familiar territory, Lord knows. And as my buddy David Finkel said the other day, everybody thinks he has a one-person show in him, and you know, I'm guilty as charged too. I've done my own in last month in both Dayton, Ohio, and St. Louis. So I mean, so I have sympathy for this point of view. We all think we have stories worth telling. So here's a woman talking about her American father and her Asian mother. And, you know, there's going to be culture conflicts between them. And you think, all right, this is going to be somewhat charming. And there are some interesting things in it at the beginning, especially where the father says, what I want for Christmas, this is all I want. I want a day of peace and quiet. I don't want anybody to talk to me. That's all I want. And I think that's a very interesting thing, that would be a present to a person, that in his own house, all he has to do is not have to deal with anybody. So you think it's going to be, you know, a lighthearted thing. And of course, there's a lot about the girl growing up and her mother criticizing her and giving her advice on sex and morals and all this. And you think it's going to be very charming. It's not. And I don't mean this as a flaw in the play. What I mean is that this young woman has much more on her mind and is about to reveal much more about her mother than one thinks. And what I really am saying is this is a play that her mother could never be behind, because if you think Rose Hovick in Gypsy is a terrible human being, whoa, she can't hold a candle to this lady. This lady truly is a monster. Suddenly you start thinking, well, you know, at least Rose the Gypsy was trying to do something constructive. I mean, she was trying to make at least one of her girls, and then the other of the girls, a star. At least there was a goal. At least there was a value system. This is about a mother who just tears down her daughter at every opportunity. And yet, of course, when the mother is in front of other people, talks about how wonderful her the daughter hears this, how wonderful she is. She's really a good girl. I'm so proud of her, all this kind of stuff. But behind closed doors, it's all criticism. She can never do anything right. And it takes a long time for the girl to realize that her mother really is a terrible human being. Now, of course, there are three sides to every story. You know, his side, her side, the true story. And in this case, I wouldn't mind seeing another version where the mother tells her side of the story. I mean, it may turn out to be that the mother says, yeah, that's the way I did it. And I have tough love, or gee, I don't see where I did anything wrong there or anything like that. But it really is fascinating to watch what you think is going to be a charming memoir turn into a real indictment of what motherhood can be at its worst. And so I found it pretty gripping in a way that I didn't expect it to at all. There is humor in it, mostly at the beginning, but as time goes on, it gets far less funny and far more potent. So I can recommend it.
All right, so that covers us for our beginning of the Fringe Festival. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about it next week. Peter just returned from a trip to the Midwest, to the heartland of America, where Sarah Palin says the real Americans are. And and you actually saw a all-female version of 1776 in Kansas City at the Music Heritage Theater. Why don't you fill us in on that?
Yeah, I was invited by Keith Edwards, who's Sherman Edwards' son, to come out and see the show because he knows how fond I am of the property, that I do consider it one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in the theater. So this would be the 13th production I have seen of 1776 in the last 40 years. And of course, it was the most different one. What was really fascinating to me is that I have never seen an audience respond so enthusiastically. There was such hearty laughter, roars, belly laughs at almost every joke. Even the 32-minute musicless scene, there is a scene where you don't hear a song for more than a half hour, got applause at the end because it was so well done. Some years ago, I went to see the Theater of the Blind, which is now called, I think, Theater Without Boundaries. And the Theater of the Blind had blind people, people who could see but had trouble seeing, and regularly sighted actors all together. And at the beginning of the play, I was thinking, oh, who's blind? Who isn't? Oh, that one can see. Oh, no, that one can't. And after a while, I just didn't even think about it and just watched the show, because after all, they put me at their ease, at my ease, and I was just able to enjoy the show as a show. Same thing here. Yes, they were all women, but they took it very seriously. There was no camp in it whatsoever in any way, shape, or form. They did the show, and they were extraordinarily convincing in what they were doing. So after a while, all I did was enjoy the show, and God knows there's a great deal to enjoy. The show actually happened because the director Sarah Crawford decided that it would be fun to do. She had all these women around, and they were all very talented, and this would be a good thing. So the theater polled its audience and said, would you like to see this? And they found out that a majority of people said yes. They then polled the audience and said, would you like to see 1776 with Deb Bluford as Ben Franklin? And then it was overwhelmingly, oh, please, yes, because this woman, Deb Bluford, is a star out in Kansas City. And she's an older, somewhat heavyset woman, and she really does have a wonderful theatrical flair. And so she was a terrific Ben Franklin. So I thought she was really quite wonderful. Katie Carell, again, these are names that are not going to be known to any of us, but nevertheless, was very good too as Rutledge, the South Carolina delegate who is concerned about the slavery issue. He wants slavery retained, and sings that dramatic song, Molasses to Rum. And I have to say that this woman sang it as well as any Rutledge I have ever seen do it, which I thought was tremendously interesting.
I'm sorry, can I interrupt for a second with a question?
Sure.
With Molasses to Rum, for example, or any other song you want to name, what did they do in terms of the vocal requirements? I mean, did she belt it? Was she a soprano? How did that work? How did they match up the women's voices with all of these songs that were written with men's vocal qualities in mind?
I honestly believe that the only time there was a problem was in the opening number, and that was Sit Down, John, where it seemed to me the keys were raised. All right. That's not a problem in itself, but when Abigail comes in the section, John, John, is that you carrying on? She had to be a super soprano. I mean, she had to hit really stratospheric notes. So that was the only time I was very much aware of any problem with any...
No. Peter, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to imply there was a problem. I was just curious how that works. I mean, what sort of voice type was the woman who played Rutledge, or Adams for that matter?
Well, they certainly weren't lyric sopranos. They were able to get down to bass notes, and they were certainly fine. There was never a strain beyond that slight strain in the opening number. And again, the lady hit the notes perfectly. I was very much aware that we were hearing higher notes than usual. But otherwise, these ladies just had voices that were able to adapt and it seemed to me sing the songs, perhaps even in the original keys. It didn't seem to be much of a problem. A woman named Cheryl Weaver played John Dickinson, the person who is against independence. And what was very interesting to me is she reminded me of Kay Thompson in Funny Face. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, but Kay Thompson is a woman who just has to have her own way at every step of the way and will not take no for an answer, so on and so forth. I also get the feeling that if Kay Thompson had been around in 1776, the Declaration would have been signed by July 3rd, you know, but that's another story. So there were a couple of snips here and there, but it was the show, but it was done in concert fashion, and that helped the all-female thing amazingly. I mean, I have a feeling if this were realistically done on the set, it would have seemed a little stranger. But as a concert, I think you should pardon the expression, got away with it. As I say, the audience was with it every step of the way, was very moved by it. I do think in a concert setting, however, it is hard to keep track of who's who in a way that it's less hard when you actually get used to seeing certain people at certain tables. So I do think that's a bit of a problem. But all in all, this was a fascinating experience for me, and it turned out far better than I expected it to. I haven't mentioned the actress who plays John Adams, and I don't remember her name, but nevertheless, I will say that she certainly did the job astonishingly well, and believe me, in my time, I have seen worse John Adams. So this was really very impressive to see her have that single-mindedness, that nothing would sway her from this goal, and that no matter how impossible it seemed, that she would not give up. And she had that tenacity really tremendously well. The Mama Look Sharp girl, I thought maybe smiled a little too much, but I will tell you this, when I found out she was 14 years old, I was very impressed because she had far more composure than I expected of a 14-year-old girl acting with Kansas City's best actresses. So I thought that was really terrific that she was able to do it. And, you know, in a way she was cast well, because there is something at the end of the show where George Washington issues a dispatch and says, I have 15-year-old kids fighting for me. And so she was really age appropriate. It was fascinating, too. I mean, some of the people were really, again, I'm using this term in a far more lighthearted way than it is usually meant. But I mean, you know, when you come right down to it, everybody's miscast, right? Well, I think that one woman was really miscast as Samuel Chase. But, you know, as I say, the audience was with it. And it was very interesting to me deep in the second act when Franklin said, "We're men, no more, no less." Nobody was snickering at the inadvertent irony. You know, we had come to accept everybody on stage, and that was fine. For the famous ending, where everybody goes to the desk and signs the declaration and winds up in the exact pose that a very famous painting had of it, that, of course, didn't happen. But the lighting designer very nicely simply illuminated everybody, each person as he was announced going up to sign the declaration. So that was kind of nice. And of course, the very famous scrim that comes down showing you the bottom of the Declaration of Independence with all the signatures, including all the people who actually aren't depicted in 1776. There are plenty who aren't. That didn't happen either. Instead, what they did was raise a flag from behind everyone, which was the flag of that time with 13 stars and, of course, 13 stripes. So again, there were tears in my eyes, as there often, well, frankly, always are whenever I see 1776. I think it's there's a lyric, "It's a masterpiece," I say. That's John Adams talking about the Declaration of Independence, but I think that's really true of the book of 1776, which I think has never been surpassed in Broadway history. And so I was very glad to be able to go and see this, because really any opportunity should be taken to see this marvelous work. It's a show that every American should see. Well, I think everybody should see, but I really believe if there's only one show that people see in their lifetime, that this should be it. Not just from entertainment value, but from the vantage point that every American should see how hard it was to get this to happen, to break away. As it's mentioned in the show, no people have ever done this. There's never been a revolution of this kind. And what's also wonderful is that Dickinson always comes up with good reasons why this revolution should not happen. Why should we break away from England? It's a great country. Who are you, Mr. Adams? We can't win. You know, we have no money. We have no army. We have no friends. You know, and the thing is, there you are nodding your head saying, he's right. He's right, and yet you don't want him to be right. So I even think when there's a mediocre production of 1776, it's worth seeing, because it just doesn't happen as often. You can say, well, there's that original cast in the movie, but you don't get the sense of suspense of the movie, because you really need to know the date, which is on a calendar, and how many colonies are voting for and against. I mean, you don't really realize in the movie that on July 1st, six colonies are for this and six colonies are against it, with one abstaining. There's only 3 days to go. You know that. You know in 72 hours it has to be solved. And you mean to tell me at this point it's a tie and it's got to be unanimous? So that's why whenever there's a stage 1776, no matter how good, bad, or indifferent, I always urge people to see it. But this one was very entertaining. And certainly it beat the odds, just as these 13 colonies beat the odds way back in 1776.
I'm reading in the Kansas City Star a review of the 1776 production that Peter's talking about, and they talked to the producer of it, and they said that the cost of mounting this production was $50,000, which is a lot for them.
Wow.
Isn't it amazing? $50,000, which is a lot for them, which I'm thinking $50,000 not even going to get you a theater rental for a week in New York, you know, off-Broadway theater.
Yeah, but frankly, I'm surprised it costs that much. I guess a lot of that is in licensing.
Salary and licensing, you know.
Yeah, but even so, I'm very surprised that it costs that much. One little nice touch was that even though all the people were dressed in black, as is the case in many concerts, there were little ascot-y type things. I don't know women's fashions to know well enough to know what they're called, but think of them as ascots. And the people who were for independence at the outset wore white ascots, while the ones who weren't wore red ones. And that was helpful. I don't mean that as time went on, when people changed their mind, that they changed their ascots. They didn't. But at least it helped you at the beginning to know who the proponents were and who the non-proponents were.
It's like the dead people in Secret Garden. That took me an hour to figure out. All right, so both of you need to get off to more Fringe shows, so we're going to wrap it up right now. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo where there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of Broadway Radio, you will get it automatically downloaded to iTunes, and you won't miss anything. If you'd like to comment to us, you can go right above that logo, and there's a comment feedback form. You can send us an email, or you can actually give us a call. Leave us a voicemail at 646-873-7695 and leave us a voicemail. And if you do that, we could play it on the podcast. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Matthew Murray, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
We have a little bonus here for your regular listeners. I had a chance to speak with John O'Hurley, who is now starring in Chicago on Broadway. And John and I had a conversation for about 10 minutes about his life in theater and other things. And I thought we'd put it on the end here for you to listen to. Thanks so much. Hi, and welcome to BroadwayRadio.com. This is James Marino, and we had the honor this afternoon of talking to John O'Hurley, who is starting in as Billy Flynn in Chicago on Broadway. John, it's your second time doing this, isn't it?
It is. It's actually more than my second time. This will be my second time on Broadway, but between then and now, I've been on the road with it all across the country. But this is a very comfortable time. I'm just looking forward to the experience once again.
Great. And you also did Spamalot out on the road, didn't you?
I've been lucky enough to have embraced what I think are two of the best leading roles in contemporary theater, King Arthur and Billy Flynn. They are diametrically opposed, but they give me a chance to kind of play two different sides of myself.
I was reading at your website, johnohurley.com, which we'll link to on our show notes as well, that you actually have quite a long pedigree in theater, that you graduated from Providence College in theater. And so, you know, I go through your biography here, and you are working. You're like a one-man entertainment team.
Well, I do a lot of different things, and I've always made the promise to myself that I will always listen to my imagination, and whatever my imagination tells me to do next, I do. And sometimes that takes me out of entertainment into business, and sometimes it has me writing books, sometimes it has me composing, but all of which I do because I just kind of listen to my imagination. But theater's always been a deep love of mine, and certainly was probably the reason I became an actor so many years ago. I love keeping it alive and continuing it. I think it's one of the purest forms of entertainment there is.
You're quite the Renaissance man. I also wanted to mention to our listeners that you also did the national tours of Pirates of Penzance, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Brigadoon, and same time next year opposite Loretta Swit. Any stories that you can tell our audience? Our audience is really, really theater aficionados. They would appreciate a story that the mainstream audience would not normally.
Oh, sure. My favorite story is I've always had a habit of I am the worst person for walking on stage with my fly down. Not intentionally, it just happens. And it's usually because it either quick changes or I'm just absent-minded. And it's happened in Chicago. Unfortunately, it never happened in Spamalot because I was wearing spandex. But that was the only reason it didn't happen. And I remember once Loretta Swit and I doing Same Time Next Year together, and because the character is changing with every scene in the show and aging in years and constantly throwing on different outfits. And the last scene, I come on the show, and she had to turn upstage and look at me and go and mouth the words, "Your fly is open, you idiot." But "you idiot" came in there, right in there, too.
Well.
But, yeah. So, anyway, there you have it. There's your special story.
Well, thank you. I also see that you've written a few books and that you have quite an affection for dogs. You want to mention?
I do. I do quite a bit of, I do a lot of motivational speaking and have a great, good feeling for the dogs in my life. I host the National Dog Show on Thanksgiving Day for NBC, as I've done for the past almost 10 years now. But I've always used dogs as a template for teaching us life lessons, and that's what the two books are that I've written.
Great. And, I have two kids. One's 2.5 and one is 7 years old, and they flip through the channels, and they get very confused when they see Family Feud up against Wizards of Waverly Place, and they hear that same familiar voice. You do quite a lot of work. You mentioned just before that you finally have taken some time for yourself, but what is a typical day for Jonah Hurley like? Are you constantly?
Well, usually, I have four businesses that I am the controlling interest in. So I'm constantly on the phone, either working financial stuff or just administrative stuff. A lot of my week is spent recording as well. I have, I've had over my career as many as 10 different animated shows that I do at the same time. I'm King Neptune on SpongeBob and half a dozen others that are still running, Scooby-Doo, Phineas and Ferb, et cetera. I'm constantly running back and forth to the studio. And then in the time of the season that I've been shooting Family Feud, I've got 165 shows of those to shoot, and I do 12 on a weekend. So that uses up most of my time. In fact, when I was doing Spamalot, I was actually shooting Family Feud during the day. I had an hour to get to the theater to then do a 2.5-hour show at night. So it was kind of, it was one of the most exhausting years of my life last year.
So you must do a lot to keep yourself healthy.
I try to. Unfortunately, I have a wonderful wife makes sure that the ways are nice and smooth.
Oh, that's good to hear. It's always it's an important partnership to have that support
it there. Sure is. Yeah. We've been very fortunate and fortunate enough to have a great 3.5-year-old son, and the three of us travel everywhere. We live backstage together, and we have a great time.
Oh, that's great to hear. Quickly, tell us about your experience on Dancing with the Stars, excuse me. And
Dancing with the Stars, yeah. Very careful, because that's a whole other show.
Exactly. Dancing with the Stars.
Dancing on a Star, Dancing Near a Star, they're all different shows. Yeah, Dancing with the Stars was, it was one of the great experiences I've had in my career. And certainly that first season we were kind of all flying blind. We were kind of that little ragtag militia there that was just trying not to fall down on stage. And no one really understood that we had a very successful show on our hands or that it was a competition. We were all very supportive of each other. For me, I was somebody who never studied dance, so it was a brand new experience for me, and it taught me a lot about myself in terms of, as I always say, if you leak, the net will appear, and I think that's how I felt every night as the dance would begin and the conductor's baton would drop. I was leaping and hoping the net would appear. Not a dancer, but certainly was able to, appear as though I was one for a few weeks.
You give inspiration to all of us that can't be really considered dancers then.
You don't know how many 50-year-old men are so mad at me right now because their wives took them to dance.
Oh, sure. Also, tell us about your little golf. Your golfing career is quite extensive, actually.
Well, golf has always been an important dynamic in my life. I played all through high school and tried to play a little bit in college, but couldn't because it conflicted so much with the theater. But it's always been kind of the sport that I've attached myself to. And then off the course, I've had a chance to host several shows in the golf arena. I had a PGA Tour show that I did for 3 years. And that's how I met my wife, which is probably the best thing that ever happened to me on a golf course. In fact, we actually got engaged on the famous seventh hole at Pebble Beach. The ring was actually in a box in the seventh hole.
That's a great story. Excellent. So tell me, how long are you to be in New York playing Billy Flynn?
I'll be back as Billy until August 30th, actually. I'll be closing and looking forward to a really good run. Once again, slapping on the tux. And actually, I'll tell you a quiet story, my a personal story. The shoes that I wear are actually my dance shoes from Dancing with the Stars. They've become like a comfortable old wallet to me, and I can't give them up.
You find good shoes, you got to stick with them.
That's right. I'll duct tape them on my body if I have to.
All right. And the very last thing before we go is I read towards the very end of your bio that you're a Boston Red Sox fan. How are we looking this year?
Well, if you're saying we, then I applaud you. It's a tough year with injuries. It's injury laden, and you know they're digging every game out they possibly could. But I've been a diehard fan since I grew up in the Boston area and watched actually the final 2 years that Ted Williams played in '59 and '60 when I was just a wee lad. But it's always been part of our kind of the thing that held our family together was the Boston Red Sox. So it's a wonderful tradition that I'm passing on to my son. It doesn't make me very popular in New York.
This is true. All right, John, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And
it's a joy to talk to you.
All right. Speak to you soon.
Thank you again.
Thanks. Bye-bye, John.